This is Mac Format This Week. 30 minutes of news, reviews, Q&A, and features for the world of the Macintosh, iPod, and iPhone. Coming up on this edition, one-on-one with Walt Mossberg.
I am writing a column for average, mainstream, non-technical users of digital products. You write it in plain English, you do break it down, you do try to explain it, but you never do it in a way that's condescending. You never talk down to them.
The Wall Street Journal's Walt Mossberg joins us for a rare interview and talks about his career, his passion for technology, and, oh yes, Apple.
OS X is the best consumer operating system, the best operating system, I think, on personal computers, and that's no small achievement.
A rare interview with Walt Mossberg, all on this edition of Mac Format This Week. With the resources of Mac Format Magazine, this is Mac Format This Week. Hello again, everyone. I'm Brad Gibson. We've got a jam-packed show for you in this edition, and although we tried very hard to keep this program at right around 30 minutes, we decided this time we'd break the rules for a very special opportunity to talk in-depth with a major player in the world of technology journalism. There are a few technology journalists on the planet as well-known, respected, and to many feared as Walt Mossberg. Since 1991, Mossberg has written his personal technology column for the Wall Street Journal. And if you've never read his work, in print or online, you're missing out on some of the most thought-provoking technology reviews you'll find anywhere. Mossberg's secret is his ability to make the complex simple, to judge products not only on their power and value, but on their ease of use, and then explain his thoughts and opinions in simple English. Not a simple task, let me tell you. That's why he's become so well-known and, frankly, feared by many companies. Mossberg's comments can make or break a product or a stock, but despite his perceived power, he doesn't take himself too seriously and sticks to the values that have made him one of the best technology columnists in the business. That's why when I approached this highly sought-after journalist for an interview, I was delighted he took me up on the offer for a rare one-on-one. In our next two episodes, we talk to Mossberg about his career, his journalistic values, technology, and everything Apple. Joining us from Washington, D.C., here's part one of our interview with Wall Street Journal personal technology columnist Walt Mossberg. Joining us today is Walt Mossberg of the Wall Street Journal. And Walt, I know you're such a busy man, and I know you don't do a lot of these types of interviews. My thanks to you first for taking the time out to be with us in the talk today. We really appreciate it.
Well, it's my pleasure, Brad.
Did you ever think when you started at the Journal back in the 70s that one day you'd be paid to basically play around with computers and gadgets?
No, I didn't, for a number of reasons. One is there were no personal computers when I first started as a reporter. And secondly, it was not, I had no interest in it, no knowledge about it at that time. And my strong interests were elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back in Walt Mossberg's career. Where did your journalism career begin?
It began in my hometown of Providence, Rhode Island. There was a newspaper there called the Providence Journal, which was highly respected, had won a number of Pulitzer Prizes, and was a place where larger papers like the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal recruited from. And I was lucky enough to get a series of jobs there, eventually becoming a reporter every summer and during school vacations. And so I got a very broad grounding in covering politics and some business and crime and, you know, all sorts of things that people cover on city newspapers.
Yeah, the kind of things that you do earlier on in your career, obviously, the cop shops and everything else, the way we always have, both you and I guess.
Yeah, I did all that. And then when I went off to college, although I continued at the Providence Journal, I also was a stringer for the New York Times, so I got some good experience doing that. Then I went to journalism graduate school at Columbia and got a master's and was hired by the Wall Street Journal. And really what I wanted to do and what I did do for 20 years was, or most of 20 years, was to cover Washington, cover policy and cover politics. And the Journal hired me. I had no intention of staying at the Journal. I knew very little about the Journal because I came from a family where no one read it. We were not stockholders and we were not employers or business folks. My family were workers.
Right.
I had never seen a stock certificate. I had never seen a corporate annual report in my life. But I knew the Wall Street Journal was a high-quality paper, and the people who were advising me at Columbia told me I'd be crazy not to join. So I joined, and I said, look, I want to work in Washington. And they said, we don't hire right out of college and send people to Washington. At least not in those days, they didn't. And so they dispatched me to Detroit, which was and is an extremely important news bureau for the Journal, because the automobile industry then was the biggest and sexiest industry in the country.
Mm-hmm.
And in some ways, it's still the biggest industry in the country, although I don't think it's the sexiest anymore.
Right.
And I spent almost 4 years there in a small news bureau we had with a total of about five reporters. And I learned a ton and wound up as the guy whose principal assignment was covering labor relations. So I covered the UAW, and I covered some strikes, and I covered kind of the plight of the worker in the auto business in those days, and some politics. Then I got sent to Washington as the national, one of the two national labor correspondents. And then I moved on to a series of other beats, eventually culminating in, I did a stint as the deputy bureau chief in Washington. Then I went back to reporting.
Yeah, I mean, you were the diplomatic correspondent for the Journal back in the 80s, and I was working for the Associated Press then. And I remember running into you in various big news events like the Bush-Gorbachev-Malta summit back in 1989 and seeing you all over town. I mean, we actually didn't know each other at the time, but crossed paths in many different ways. So your career really grew over time.
Yeah, In most of the 80s, I was covering either something to do with international affairs or national security. I was the chief Pentagon correspondent. I was the chief trade and international economics correspondent. And then I was what we called here and still do, I think, call the national security correspondent, which meant I covered the State Department. In those days, the Cold War, really, U.S.-Soviet relations. I covered the intelligence community. I covered the Gulf War in 1991, and really had the great luck of having that beat, and perhaps you did too, at one of those momentous periods of history, which was the end of the Cold War, the collapse of the Soviet Union,
right.
the liberation of Eastern Europe, the reunification of Germany, and then eventually the Gulf War. So it was an incredibly rewarding and exciting period.
Yeah, it really was. And at what point in your Wall Street Journal career did you start reviewing technology or start doing technology that led to what you're doing today?
Well, it was pretty abrupt. It wasn't a gradual thing. In about 1990, really at the height of this great period of the end of the Cold War, I realized two things. One was personal. I was traveling an immense amount, usually on the Secretary of State's airplane and covering his activities. But I wasn't, and that meant I wasn't home enough. And I had young kids and really felt like I wasn't seeing them enough. And then on a professional level, I had by then for about 10 years become a computer hobbyist, become hooked on computers, and decided that we were about to see, obviously the personal computer in 1990 wasn't new, but it was still not democratized. There were still tens and tens of millions of people who had very little contact with them, didn't own them,
right.
Or maybe they used them at work, but they didn't really get into it. And I felt like both personal computers and associated things like cell phones and digital cameras were about to explode. So I went to see the managing editor of the Journal in 1990, and here I was, a very senior, probably one of their, 10 most senior reporters with a terrific beat. And I said, I don't want to do this anymore. I have this idea to write this computer column. And I explained that I wanted to do it in a different way than was being done on other newspapers. And he agreed, but he said, I can't have you do that for at least another year because I'm not going to switch reporters on the beat you're on just when all this stuff is going on around the world. So a year later in 1991, after the Gulf War, I switched over and spent a little time gearing up on the industry and figuring out what I was going to do and making contacts. And in the fall of 1991, I launched my personal technology column. So there was no gradual run-up to it. And in the beginning of 1991, I literally was writing front-page stories about Iraq lobbing missiles into Israel. And in October of 1991, I was writing my tech column.
Well, that's a really big difference. I mean, you're writing the diplomatic and the hard news side, and then probably in the evening when you change your mind or change your mindset, you're writing about technology. That must have been a difficult thing to do for a while.
It was difficult to make the switch, but it was a lot of fun. It was very exciting. And I guess the oddest part about it was that in both the world of Washington, where I continued to live by choice, and in the world of tech, people were saying, well, who is this guy? I mean, the first words Bill Gates actually ever said to me after he said hello when I met him, which was, I don't know, about 60 days after I started the column, was, where did you come from? Because he, at that, remember, the industry was much smaller, and he at that time knew pretty much all the tech reporters, and he read the Wall Street Journal faithfully, and here I was, not just being a reporter covering companies, but actually reviewing and passing judgment on these products. And then on the Washington side, they were all convinced that there, a lot of the senior folks in the State Department and the National Security Council and the White House, who I knew quite well, thought that I had been demoted because they really didn't understand this whole computer and tech business.
Right.
Some would say the government still doesn't understand it very well, but they certainly didn't understand it then. The State Department even then was primarily run on Wang word processors. There were a few advanced people that had laptops, but not many. So, you know, people were literally looking at me as if I died on the street. And then the column took off. After a couple of months, it became one of the two or three most popular regular features in the journal. And then it sort of dawned on people that this really wasn't such a dumb move after all.
I don't know many other technology writers that have as much respect as you, but also have as much power as you. I mean, it's been called the Mossberg effect, that you write something and you can make a stock take off or a stock plummet. I mean, do you think you have that much power after all these years?
No. And in particular, I think it's important for me to say that I'm not writing an investment column. I never, ever, ever imagine or desire that anyone would trade stocks, buy or sell their shares of stock based on what I do. I am writing a column for average, mainstream, non-technical users of digital products, which I am reviewing the products, kind of like a movie reviewer, really. It's an opinion column. It's subjective. I am paid to give my opinions after I have tested products. And you can go back through all of them back to 1991. You'll never see one even guarded, hidden reference to a company whose product I'm reviewing is worth investing in. And so you're right. Some people have written articles. There have even been a couple of academic papers written that attempt to measure the influence of the columns I've written based on the changes in stock prices. And I wince when I see those things, because even if you were to believe that I was somehow infallible, which I am certainly not, or that I had all this power so that if I gave a product a bad review, the company would suffer, or a good review, the company would be in great shape. Even if they make a good product, or even if they make a bad product, I'm not looking into many, many other factors that should guide somebody making an investment, like how do they manage their money and what kind of leadership do they have at the company. I just don't get into all of that. In fact, Brad, you probably won't believe this, but you could put a gun to my head and I could not tell you, even within 10%, what the stock price is today of Microsoft or Dell or Apple or Google. I just don't know. And I don't pay any attention to it. I don't own stock in any tech company whose products I might review or could review. So it's just the farthest thing from my mind.
But although it's the farthest thing from your mind, you see this effect. It must be difficult at times to block that out of your mind in terms of what you're reviewing and what you're saying. I mean, is it difficult at times?
Well, I'm well aware that if I write a positive review of, let's say, a website or a digital camera or a piece of software or something, that it's likely to boost the sales or the interest in that product. That I'm aware of. And I'm also aware that if I write a bad review, it may hurt that product. So I take that as a very serious responsibility, and it's why I don't lightly rave about things or trash things. But it is actually never, never anywhere in my mind that this may affect the company's stock price. So that's easy. I have no difficulty. I never sit down and say, well, geez, maybe I better soften the wording here because the company stock might fall, or because I don't want to cause a rally in the stock. I just never think about the stock. I just don't.
I'd like to talk to you about technology in general for a few minutes. I mean, I think the thing that impresses me the most about your writing is the simplicity at which you comment about a product. It's almost as if you don't take all this stuff so seriously as the rest of us do, and you just simply break it down into simple terms.
Well, let me go back to the beginning. When I proposed to write this column, which has now become, there now are three columns that I oversee. I write two of them directly, and a terrifically talented young woman, Catherine Barrett, who works for me, writes the third that run every week. When I started, every other newspaper had one of these columns. We were the last one, last big newspaper to start one. And in those days, these columns were primarily written by geeks for geeks. Some papers, and I'm not making this up, literally got some guy out of the IT department who wasn't a journalist at all and pressed him, and I say him because it was always a him, into service to do this. And my proposal to the journal, and one reason the editor bought it so quickly, was that we should turn the formula on its head, that we should not write for geeks, and we should not write in geek language, and then in fact we should champion mainstream non-techie user of these products who had no interest in being a techie, never would be, never wanted to be a techie. A lot of these other columns dripped with condescension toward these people. The other factor in the other columns was that they tended to be reverential about the industry. My promise to my editors was that if they gave me the license to have opinions and be subjective, I would be hard on the industry when I thought they were not serving the interests of these non-technical users. And I would be hard on them even if they were advertisers in the paper. And that's what I've done. And the editors have, over 16 years, changed, but they have never changed in their attitude toward me and my columns, which is they've left me alone. So now there are a lot of columns in that mold, but transport yourself back to 1991, there weren't any columns like this at that time. And one of the things you do when you're writing for those kind of users is you respect them. You write it in plain English, you do break it down, you do try to explain it, but you never do it in a way that's condescending. You never talk down to them. When I sit down in the morning to write one of these columns, and the same is true of my colleague, Katie Barrett, we imagine the reader is a smart person, that she is somebody who probably has an important job, probably has a good education, because this is the Wall Street Journal, and we do have that kind of readership. But they don't know how the computer works inside. They don't know what a digital camera sensor is. They don't know the difference between GSM and CDMA on phones. And, you know, they don't want to know. They just want, they're busy people, and they just want to be able to use the digital tools that are best for their lives. And to some extent, they want to understand these broad trends, because sometimes I write columns that are not product reviews, but that are attempts to explain the broad trends. And so, yeah, I do break it down and I do write it in English, but I don't talk down to the reader.
Back in 1991, you wrote that, and I'm going to get this quote exactly right, personal computers are just too hard to use and it isn't your fault. Do you still feel that way today, or have they actually really gotten simpler as the technology gets more complex?
Well, I think it goes in waves. Clearly, a personal computer today, even if it were to be purchased by someone who had never seen one, and there are way fewer of those people, would be easier to use. Because remember that when I was writing in 1991, most of the computers on the market used command line interfaces, what I call secret handshake software, whether it was DOS or whether it was something like Lotus 1-2-3 or WordPerfect, where you really had to spend a lot of time learning the commands. And once you knew the commands, you sort of put yourself in a superior class. That was really the way the other columnists wrote. I mean, they wrote for those people who had mastered all those commands and syntax, and they sort of pitied or disdained the people that hadn't. And the idea that was that you were either a techie and had figured that stuff out, as well as some hardware things like how to put individual memory chips in your computer, you know, or whatever. 1991, most computers didn't have sound cards. I mean, I know Macs were different, but most computers were not Macs, and they didn't have these things. So, yes, computers are easier today. However, I believe that thing has gone in waves. I think as additional issues have arisen or features have come to computers, brand new levels of complexity have occurred that then have taken some years to smooth out. One example, when the security threats began to arise for DOS and Windows computers, they got complicated, more complicated again to operate. And because of the way Microsoft and the computer vendors reacted in trying to protect the users. And, you know, when we began to have digital photography, when we began to have the internet and email and IM and a lot of that stuff, a lot of this stuff starts in a fairly clumsy way, and then it gets better.
Let's switch gears to Apple, being that we're a Mac podcast here. You've written a lot about Apple over the years, some good, some bad. But I think you've always been impressed, or I've always been impressed, with the innovation that Apple has brought to the table. I mean, what's your take on Apple as an innovator?
Again, I think it has gone in waves. They obviously were a huge innovator almost by definition, because 31 years ago when they brought out the Apple II, it was the first really broadly successful mass market computer. There were a couple of others from Commodore and from Radio Shack Tandy, but the Apple II had the biggest impact. And so in a way, they popularized the very idea of a personal computer that someone who wasn't an engineer could use. And then again, as we all know, in 1984, they took a lot of the work that had been done at Xerox PARC on graphical user interfaces. They refined it, they improved it, and then they made it real in the mass market with the Mac, which was ridicule, but every computer now looks like or operates something like the Mac did in 1984. Right. So that's huge innovation. However, anyone fairly looking at Apple, and then there were a series of additional innovations, but anyone fairly looking at Apple would realize that by the early 90s and the mid-90s, they had really stopped doing big innovations. They were in a lot of trouble. They were very badly led. Their products had become essentially mediocre. They could not get a new modern operating system out the door. They had this project that went on for years that some of your listeners may remember called Copeland, which they just never could get out the door. And so by 1995, Windows had essentially caught up, in my opinion, and I said so. I wrote that. Windows 95 pretty much caught up to the Mac operating system, and the Windows hardware from Dell and others in those days began to come with a sound card and come with a modem and some of the things that come with a CD drive like Macs did. And Apple was essentially asleep at the switch, to the point where in 1997, I think it was, not very long before Steve Jobs returned, and I didn't know he was returning, I wrote a column telling my readers, don't buy a Mac. I wrote a column literally saying, don't buy a Mac, because it was a mess. And Gilbert Amelio, who was then running the company, his plan to save them was to basically become more of a corporate, make it into more of a corporate product. You got to remember, I write for consumers. I don't write for corporate users. I don't write for IT departments. I don't write for techies, enthusiasts, or hobbyists. I write for mainstream consumers. So from that lens, I decided, after being fairly positive about the Mac earlier, that it was cooked and you shouldn't bother with it, and that Windows 95 was at that time a better way to go. So yes, obviously then Jobs came back, and we've seen another bunch of innovation and leadership and gutsy moves by Apple.
Walt Mossberg writes about technology for the Wall Street Journal. He spoke to us from Washington, D.C. You can check out Mossberg's column for free every week by clicking on our enhanced podcast link right now. In part two of our interview with Walt Mossberg, we talk about everything Apple, from the Mac to the iPod to the iPhone to the MacBook Air and Steve Jobs. That's in our next episode you'll find on Monday, the 26th of May. So what are your thoughts on Walt Mossberg and his comments and his columns? Does his work help you better understand the Mac and technology? Email us at macformatthisweek@futurenet.co.uk. We'll share your thoughts on our next episode. Again, our email address is macformatthisweek@futurenet.co.uk, and we look forward to hearing from you soon. It's time for our shareware picks of the month for June with Craig Grinnell. Hello, Craig. Thanks for joining us again.
Hi, Brad. How are you doing?
I'm very good, and we're going to talk about two products today, Photonic, which gets your photos uploaded to Flickr with a minimum of fuss, and MousePose, which is a utility for displaying mouse clicks and keystrokes. And let's begin with Photonic. Tell us about what Photonic is and what it does.
Well, it's essentially a Mac-native client for uploading photos to Flickr, but it also enables you to search Flickr really easily as well.
Now, Flickr already has great tools for doing those things, but why should a user buy a separate piece of software to do them?
Well, the thing is, I guess if you're an occasional user who only uploads the odd photo to Flickr now and again, you probably shouldn't. But if you're a really regular user who's always on Flickr, the thing is you can use a separate app to really plan what you're going to do over a period of time. Use a standalone app to sort of manage your uploads, essentially. Also, you can be offline when you're working on what to upload. So, say if you're on a train, you don't have any web connection, you obviously can't access the Flickr website, but you'd be able to use Photonic to actually sort out all of your tags and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And also, the search interface is very, very focused, so there's less chance of it, you're kind of being distracted. You know, if you've got this standalone client sitting there, you're not kind of on Flickr and you think, well, you know, maybe I'll check my Gmail, maybe I'll check the news and so on.
Mm-hmm. Now, you just said how much you liked it because it was focused. How focused is it?
Well, the thing is, I think too many applications these days try to be everything to everyone. They have all these features, and they kind of throw in another feature, and it just, you know, they become really bloated.
Yeah, exactly.
And certainly, if you look at the, you know, the larger applications out there by, you know, Adobe, Microsoft, they tend to have that criticism level a lot of the time. Photonic, on the other hand, it does a very specific thing. It does it very well. There's no bloat. It's quite lightweight, so it doesn't really, you know, strain your processor too much. And then for other things like editing and photo management, you know, you've always got iPhoto and a whole slew of other apps anyway.
Speaking of iPhoto, does Photonic integrate with iPhoto?
No, not in a direct way, and I guess that is one feature that a few users are going to be kind of irked that it doesn't exist. But the thing is, you know, there's drag and drop capability. You can just drag things from iPhoto's interface directly to Photonic, so I didn't really see that as a major problem.
Now, you gave Photonic a 4 out of 5 rating. What was your thinking behind that rating?
Well, I think it does what it does very, very well. It's fast, it's efficient, and, you know, it's not free, but it's worth the money. I think it's £13 or thereabouts, so it's, you know, it's not exactly a huge outlay. It does have a few drawbacks. First, you can't actually create a new photo set from within the application. You actually have to do that on Flickr, although you can add to existing sets that you've already set up. The other thing as well is I kind of found it a bit weird that you have to manually refresh it quite a lot. It doesn't, you know, if you upload something, it doesn't automatically show your photo stream as it is. Mm-hmm. It shows it as it was.
Yeah.
And really, you need to have a refresh button on the toolbar. Kind of a minor thing, but it is a bit irritating. But, you know, it's solid, it's focused, and I really hope it stays that way.
Now, you just mentioned some drawbacks to Photonic. Are those drawbacks because of Flickr that they can't overcome, or are they new features that you think could be added in the future?
I mean, maybe it's a mixture of the two. I don't know. I don't, you know how this application was put together. You know, I'm not a programmer. But the thing is, certainly the refresh thing is something that could be sorted, at least in a preference. You know, there should be a preference setting that says, once you've uploaded stuff, should it automatically update your stream, or should you be able to do it manually? But like I said, I mean, it's not really a big problem. It's got quirks, but they're not really deal breakers. And if you're a Flickr user, it's definitely worth checking this application out.
All right, so that's Photonic version 1.01, £13. You can get to it through our enhanced podcast link. And again, Craig gave it a 4 out of 5 rating. Let's turn to our next product, which also got a 4 out of 5. It is MousePose version 3.02. Craig, we've all heard about Exposé. What is MousePose?
Well, in a sense, it's the same kind of thing as Exposé, but for a mouse cursor. I mean, Exposé essentially enables you to focus in on one window out of a whole selection. And what this enables you to do is draw attention to a mouse cursor using a keyboard shortcut. And it's also got a bunch of other features as well, so you can show things like on-screen mouse clicks and keystrokes.
So what kind of user would want this functionality?
It's a very niche product, it has to be said. This isn't something that every Mac user out there is going to need. However, if you're doing sort of tutorial-oriented presentations, it's really, really handy. So, for example, if you're doing a screencast, it can show what keys are being pressed and where the cursor currently is on screen, sort of draw focus into it. And in screencasts, especially when the screen is reduced in size, that's very, very handy. Also, if you're doing a sort of a live presentation in front of an audience, it's actually handy as well. So if you're doing something like a big Photoshop tutorial in front of a live audience, you can show the keystrokes that you're using.
Mm-hmm.
Makes it easier for people to take notes. Thing is, I did actually think of one other use as well that's kind of handy. If you've got one of these big, big Apple screens, or, well, someone else's screen for that matter,
right,
it's quite easy to lose your cursor, especially when you're using something like Photoshop and the sort of standard cursor becomes a tiny, tiny little crosshair or something.
Yeah.
And so MousePosé actually kind of, you could use a shortcut and go, bosh, there you go, there's where my cursor is, carry on working, no sort of dragging your mouse around the screen to find where it's actually gone to.
Yeah, it's a really great idea, actually. How flexible is the display that MousePosé offers?
It's actually pretty good, and it's something that the guys at Boink Software have eventually been adding to over time with MousePosé. So now, for mouse clicks, you can define the circle radius, the color, the opacity, and also toggle the animations on and off. And also, really handily as well, you can now differentiate between left and right clicks, and also what they term as other clicks, I guess like middle clicks, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Different colors for each one, which is very, very handy for doing, again, screencasts and presentations. For keystrokes, you can define the fades, the font size, the opacity, and the color. And usefully, very handy thing this, you can also filter keystrokes, so you only show modifiers if you want to. And you can also omit the MousePosé hotkeys. And one other thing new in MousePosé 3 is that you can now focus on windows when you pause the cursor over them, which is kind of handy too.
Now, it sounds just about perfect for its target audience, and you gave it a 4 out of 5 rating. Why didn't you score it higher?
To be honest, I thought there were some sort of usability quirks. It just kind of, there were certain things in there kind of hard to put my finger on, but it just didn't feel like a Choice Award winner. However, I think it still comes recommended, and certainly if you do a lot of presentations or screencasts, it's worth checking out.
All right, so that's MousePosé version 3.02, about £9 from Boink Software. You can get through it through our enhanced podcast link. Craig, thanks so much for going over Photonic and MousePosé. We'll see you again next month.
Okay, see ya.
Craig Grinnell reviews shareware for MacFormat magazine. His picks for the month of June begin on page 100 in MacFormat. The daddy of disk burning is back with an update. Is it worth it? And Apple's Time Machine software is great, but is it even better with a wireless hard disk? MacFormat's Chris Finn joins us to review Roxio Toast Titanium 9 and Apple's Time Capsule 500GB wireless backup system. Chris, thanks for being with us.
Always a pleasure, Brett.
Let's dive right in and begin with Roxio Toast Titanium 9. With Titanium, you can burn data, audio, and video, but with version 9, you can do so much more. Tell us what this version does.
The big news really is support for HD video, high definition video. Now you can actually burn HD video as well, either in the HD DVD format or the now victorious Blu-ray format as well. And in fact, it can go one better because it can actually sort of fake a Blu-ray disc by burning onto a standard DVD. It only gives you about 20 minutes worth of HD footage, but that's enough for maybe a sort of holiday video from your family or perhaps a sort of showreel as well. But it's worth bearing in mind that this ability is extra. It's a £15 plugin that you have to buy to allow you to record to HD DVD or Blu-ray video discs. They have made some other little changes as well with HD. One of the nice things actually is the support for burning directly from a camcorder that supports the new AVC HD format. Cameras like the Canon HG10 that I reviewed a few issues back, you can plug that straight into your Mac and burn the video, dump it straight onto a Blu-ray disc without having to muck about with editing in between. It's a really good way of just archiving off your footage very, very quickly. Now obviously Toast is a suite, and there's a bunch of really lovely companion apps that goes along with it, most of which have been updated in Toast 9. We've got a CD Spin Doctor that does its thing very well, cleaning up crappy, sort of crackly audio, maybe from LPs. And it's got a new feature in there, a sort of audio fingerprinting thing, where if you import, let's say, a bit of vinyl into your Mac, it can automatically sort of chop up the track into the each individual track and then go up to the Gracenote service and pull down all the metadata to do with those songs. So you can pull down, you know, the artist, the track name, the album name, the date it was recorded, all that sort of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a really, really handy way of actually quickly importing your video. There's a new little app in there called Streamer, which is similar to Elgato's sort of server software that allows you to stream video files from your Mac to, let's say, an iPhone or an iPod Touch that's on the same local connection. And rounding all that really nicely is another cracking little new app from Beelight Software called Get Backup, which is, as the name suggests, is a little backup app. It's not phenomenally rich, but it's a really good, solid little application, and it really does make that a very, very compelling suite of apps.
Okay, so lots of new great features, but the bottom line here is it compelling enough to pay basically £55 for the upgrade?
unless you actually need the ability to burn high-definition video, I don't think it is worth the upgrade. I mean, it's £55, which is an awful lot of money, and you don't really get all that much unless you particularly want the ability to burn HD. There's a few interface tweaks. It's been streamlined and smartened up and polished. It looks really good, and it's a good suite, but as far as the upgrade goes, I'm not convinced it's necessarily worth that £55. Now, if you don't already own a copy of Toast, it's £70 to buy the application from scratch, buy the suite from scratch, and I think that is definitely worth it. You get an awful lot of functionality for that money, even though it's quite a lot of money for what is effectively just sort of a big utility.
All right, so still worth 5 out of 5 stars for a Mac Choice Award despite the £55 upgrade. Roxio Toast Titanium 9, you really liked it. Let's move on to our next product, which we're going to review, and that's Apple's Time Capsule. It's a 500 gigabyte wireless hard disk that basically combines hardware with Apple's Time Machine software, which many of us have heard. Tell us about it.
Yeah, as you say, it's basically a Wi-Fi hard disk. It's a hard disk, a 500 gig or 1 terabyte hard disk inside what is effectively a sort of overgrown Airport Extreme base station case. It's got 802.11n wireless functionality built into it, so it can create a wireless network or it can join a wireless network if you really have one existing, or if you have another Apple router or indeed another router that supports a WDS standard, you can actually extend your wireless network as well using that. There's a USB port in the back, so you can share a disk or you can share a printer. And it's worth noting here that although the Airport Extreme can share disks and printers, the Airport Express can only share printers. It can't do the disk bit. Obviously, the big news for Mac users here is its integration with Time Machine. Time Machine, obviously, is Apple's backup engine that's built into 10.5, which allows you to do hourly, versioned, and incremental backups to some sort of storage medium.
Right.
The problem with Time Machine, as it stands, particularly if you're a laptop user, is that in order to be able to be being backed up, you've got to be connected to a hard disk. You've got to have a hard disk tethered to your Mac, which is obviously inconvenient. The whole reason you bought a laptop is so you don't have to be tied down. You can use it wherever you want. With Time Machine, the time capsule can be set up out of the way. It can be hidden away. You could even sort of hide it away in a cupboard somewhere so that even in the unfortunate event that you are burgled, somebody won't necessarily see that, so your data could be safe. And that every hour, wirelessly, transparently, automatically, without you doing anything, your data is backed up over the network to the time capsule.
Now, you wrote that it is quite simply the easiest and most convenient backup system ever, but as you said, if you're going to be dedicated to Wi-Fi to connect to this time capsule, that might be a real problem depending upon how much you back up and how much changes using Time Machine to Time Capsule, right?
Yeah, Wi-Fi is fantastically convenient, but it can be quite slow, particularly compared to Ethernet. I mean, if you've got a pure 802.11n network, then you should be okay. But if you have even one 802.11g or even an 802.11b device on your network, that's going to slow everything down, and it can take a very, very long time indeed to actually do your initial backup. Now, after that initial backup, it's incremental. Only the files that have changed since your last backup are actually moved across your Wi-Fi network to the time capsule. But for that initial backup, we found that we just couldn't do over Wi-Fi, we had to go Ethernet. And it's easy enough to set up your time capsule to do Ethernet first and then switch to Wi-Fi, but there's actually no walkthrough, there's no help given to you in the manual for how you do that.
Now, there were some flaws with Time Capsule. You'd like to see some improvements. What are they?
Security is a big problem. If you've got a work group of people all backing up to the same time capsule, then they all have the same login, the same password for that time capsule. And once your files are copied up to it, they're just accessible. It's just an open system of files and folders. So you've got to trust your work colleagues or your children, your spouse, or anyone else on the same network as you, that they will, because they will have access to your files. I also have a problem with location awareness. To take me as an example, I've got a hard disk in the office that I use for Time Machine while I'm working at Mac Format, and I've got a time capsule at home. Now, there's currently no way of automatically switching between those two locations. I'd quite like some sort of location awareness based on maybe the SSID of the Wi-Fi network I connect to that allows me to switch my Time Machine target depending on where I am, so that if I open my Mac at the office, it automatically knows to be looking for the FireWire hard disk. And similarly, when I go home, it knows that there's a time capsule there and it should be looking to back up to that. But the biggest problem I have with Time Capsule is the whole Time Machine system, which is a very good, easy and convenient way of actually doing backup. But it's not perfect, and I really worry that people trust their entire backup strategy to this one device, which is quite a short-sighted thing to do. I mean, backup's all about mitigating risk, and the more ways you can back up, the more different those ways are, the more secure your backup system is. Things can and will go wrong.
All right, so Chris, you gave it 4.5 stars. It's not the most perfect system, but it certainly is the most convenient and easiest to use.
Absolutely. It's a very convenient, easy-to-use system. And if you're feeling at all nervous about backup, this is certainly a really good, solid first step towards a full, proper backup strategy.
All right, so that's a quick look at Apple's Time Capsule at £155. And if you like the sound of the Time Capsule system and you already own an Airport Extreme base station, you'll love the PDF that we've included with this podcast through iTunes. It shows you how to hook up a USB hard disk to your base station and use it as a Time Machine target volume, just like Time Capsule does. It's officially not supported by Apple, but it's working great for us here at Mac Format, and it's a PDF worth taking a look at on iTunes. Chris, thanks again for joining us.
My pleasure, Brad. Thank you.
Chris Finn is the deputy editor of Mac Format magazine. His reviews begin on page 86 in the June issue of Mac Format. Every episode of Mac Format this week, we answer your questions with Trevor Middleton, and he rejoins us now. Hello, Trevor.
Hey there, Brett. How's it going?
Very good. Thanks for joining us again. You can email Trevor with your questions to machelpme@futurenet.co.uk and tell us where you're from. And more importantly, if your name's a little bit tough to pronounce, tell us how to pronounce it. Question one is from David Arneth in Cardiff, Wales, who wrote, I just bought an Airport Express to use for streaming music and wireless printing. Once I got it up and running, I set it up to join my Airport Extreme network, which also has another Express connected to it. I found that I didn't need to connect the new Airport Express to my existing network for it to stream music, so I left it alone. At first, the music streamed perfectly to my Harman Kardon sound sticks, but now the music will skip as if it were playing from a CD. Is there a fix for this, or is it a problem with my network?
Okay, well, first of all, I try updating your Airport Express firmware to version 6.3, if it isn't already on that version, that is. Apple specifically mentioned when version 6.3 was released that it should fix issues relating to audio dropouts. Now, if that doesn't fix the problem, some users have reported that changing the speaker settings in iTunes to enable multiple speakers stops their audio breaking up. You might also look at whether your two networks are interfering with each other, or even whether another device, such as a Bluetooth phone, or even a microwave oven, is exerting an influence over that airport network. Brad?
And question two comes to us from Morris Solomon in Miami, Florida. He writes, I'm a real estate broker that views online listings, and I need Internet Explorer 6. Everyone says I need to run Fusion and a new copy of Windows XP SP2. They also advised against the OEM version of XP. Couldn't I simply use Safari's ability to mimic Internet Explorer with the listings database, or will I need the full version of Windows? Trevor.
Right, well, first of all, for those of you who ever had a really frustrating experience of going to a website only to find a page telling you that it doesn't support Safari, there is a fix for that, as Morris alludes to in his question. There is actually a hidden menu in Safari. In the latest version, it's called the Develop menu. In the earlier versions, it was called the Debug menu. And that contains the option of telling Safari to emulate Internet Explorer for Windows. If you want to enable it, you can either use the command line tool you'll find on the Apple support pages, or you can use a utility such as Tinkertool. Now, moving on to Morris's question, the bad news is that the develop menu simply instructs Safari's rendering engine to interpret website code in the same way as Internet Explorer. In other words, Morris, it's okay for viewing pages you might not otherwise have access to, but you'll still need a specified version of Explorer and Windows for the database that you describe, because you have to perform additional software installations under Windows. Now, as to whether you go for the OEM version of XP or the full version, well, they are the same. And if your colleagues have ever bought a PC with Windows XP pre-installed, they'll actually have been using the OEM version, which is simply the same version of Windows in a less pretty box, as it's intended for people who like to build their own PCs, as I must admit I do from time to time. So yes, by all means, go ahead with the OEM version. Brad?
All right, our final question is from Mark Pierce of Hastings, East Sussex. He wrote, I've tried to store documents created in the Leopard version of Pages 08 on my .Mac iDisk. If I open them in my MacBook, all is well. If I go to work and access the documents on a Windows PC, I get a Windows folder containing a zip file of an XML document and some PDF thumbnails of lower quality versions of the document. What's happening here? My colleagues and I need to be able to edit the documents, so exporting to PDF is not really an option. is there a way I can create a document in Pages 08, store it on my iDisk, and retrieve an editable, correctable, formatted version at work the next day? Trevor.
Well, the key to this one, Mark, is common formats. You're using Windows and Word at work. You're using Pages with your Mac at home. And the common format to both of those is a Word document. You can actually export a Pages document as a Word file. And the way to do that is to go to the File menu in Pages, choose Export, and then click on Word in the toolbar. Now, what I'd also do is check that your documents have the .doc file name extension, which denotes a Word document. Otherwise, your PC won't know what they are. To do that, just make sure there isn't a tick next to Hide Extension when you're saving the document. Upload them, and you should find that they open okay in Word for Windows. I've done this myself. It does work. If it doesn't work for you, get back to me, and I'll help you more. Brad.
All right, Trevor, some tough ones this time around. Thanks so much for helping us again.
No problem at all. See you next time.
You can email your questions to Trevor at machelpme@futurenet.co.uk. Please tell us where you're from and how to pronounce your name. And that's it for another edition of Mac Format This Week. My thanks to Walt Mossberg, Chris Finn, Craig Grinnell, and Trevor Middleton. Our associate producer is Misha Sakalaropoulou. You can always send us your comments and suggestions to macformatthisweek@futurenet.co.uk. Join us again for our next edition on Monday, the 26th of May. Until then, I'm Brad Gibson. Thanks for joining us.